First of all, I'm sorry for my voice. It's not COVID, as I already told many of you. I've got tested extensively, but unfortunately I got this cold following the flu jab. But yeah, anyway, first of all, thank you so much to Barbara and to Nicola for organizing this amazing meeting. It's my first presential one after a long time. It's great to be here. It's an honor to present my work. So this is some work we've been doing as part of our group for some years now. So we are trying to constrain mantle flow patterns using seismic anisotropy. And obviously credit has to be given to many of my collaborators, particularly Sangjun Chang from Kangwon University, Manuele Facenda from Padova University, and as well a number of students, postdocs and collaborators who are now spread all over the world. I always like to show these great global mantle models. As we've seen yesterday, there has been a great progress in these geodynamical models in the past decades or so. And they show lots of really exciting and fascinating features, from plumes with all sorts of shapes, which then eventually can even initiate subduction, as shown here. We can see all of these very exciting interactions between plumes and slabs. And so lots of really very interesting features. We can obviously learn a lot about what's going on inside the Earth and other planets with these models. But ultimately, I think we will all agree these are models and we need to be able to constrain them. And this is where seismology can really play a big role. This is a particular aspect that really interests me. So to use seismic data and more specifically tomography models to try to test and constrain global geodynamical models. Now, in particular, seismic anisotropy is a very, very important property to try to constrain mantle flow. Jean-Paul gave a really very nice introduction to seismic anisotropy yesterday. So as you all know, it's the directional dependency of seismic wave speed. So if we take this analogy here, the left direction would be the fast one, the right direction would be the slow one. So you might take the left one. When it comes to choosing, when it comes to mechanisms generating anisotropy, there are different possible mechanisms. Again, as Jean-Paul very nicely explained yesterday, so there can be lattice preferred orientation. So that's when basically we get the preferential alignment of mineral crystals in the Earth's interior that are intrinsically anisotropic, and that alignment might be due to mantle flow. And so if that is the case, by mapping anisotropy, we can really pretty much directly or almost directly constrain mantle flow. Alternatively, shape-preferred orientation is another possible mechanism, which might be due to this, if we have stacks of materials with very strong contrasting properties between them, or, for example, if we have layers of melt or of cracks. But regardless of the mechanism, by mapping anisotropy, it's really arguably one of the most direct ways to try to constrain mantle flow, but as well these processes here. Now, what are the regions on Earth that are anisotropic? So it has been very well established by now that the upper mantle is anisotropic, basically being dominated by olivine that has a strong single crystal intrinsic anisotropy. And even the PREM model already incorporated anisotropy from the MOHO to 220 kilometers depth. And as we get deeper inside the Earth, it's more debated. So I believe we really have now strong evidence that the lowermost mantle, at least regions of the lowermost mantle, are anisotropic. But when it comes to the rest of the lower mantle, it's really not so clear. And as well, there is a debate whether the transition zone is anisotropic or not. Now, there are many very, very interesting dynamic features in these regions. So we all know our seismic observations show stagnant slabs at the bottom of the transition zone and even in the uppermost lower mantle. We also have plumes that seem to spread laterally in these regions. It has been suggested that the transition zone might be a water reservoir, maybe a boundary layer. And so if observable anisotropy develops in these regions, by studying it, we can really understand these different phenomena and better understand the dynamics of the interior of our planet. Now, how can we constrain anisotropy? So again, this is just a quick recap following what Jean-Paul introduced yesterday. So shear wave splitting, it's a very, very popular technique to map an anisotropy, but it has a limited depth resolution. But there have been many interesting studies. I just highlighted one here that highlighted the presence of anisotropy in this the Tonga region, in the uppermost lower mantle, and also in the transition zone. Alternatively, or in a complementary way, we can do tomography, anisotropy tomography, either radial or and or azimuthal anisotropy tomography. And there are also some other exciting observables, such as polarities of body wave reflections that Tine is going to cover later on today. So here I show just an example from the Lyon group of azimuthal anisotropy in the upper mantle, which as well seems to be more and more well established. But again, when it comes to the transition zone and lower mantle, it's not so clear whether it is azimuthally anisotropic. So today I'm going to focus mostly really on radial anisotropy tomography. That's something that I've been working on. And radial anisotropy is the simplest type of anisotropy. It's the difference between vertically polarized and horizontally polarized shear wave speed. And so it can help us distinguishing between vertical and horizontal flow, potentially. And so I will show some results and also some updates of a global whole mantle radial anisotropic model that we built some years ago now, called S-GlobeRANI. So here I just show some depth sections of isotropic structure and radial anisotropic structure here in the upper mantle. And just to switch your minds, just bear in mind that when we look at, as you all know, on these isotropic maps, as we've seen yesterday, very nice talks by Steve and Stephanie and so on. As you all know, when it's red or yellow, we are talking about slow regions. Blue regions correspond to fast regions. When it comes to this representation here of radial anisotropy, these blue regions correspond to fast, horizontally polarized shear wave speed, whereas red and yellow regions correspond to fast, vertically polarized shear wave speed. And so we see, for example, here at 150 kilometers depth, this is a very well-known radial anisotropic anomaly beneath the Pacific, which is thought to reflect some sort of horizontal flow direction. Obviously, as we go deeper inside the Earth, there is no longer this one-to-one relationship because the slip systems of the dominant mineral phases are more complicated. And what you can see already is that as we get deeper inside the Earth, into the transition zone, but also into the top part of the lower mantle, the anisotropy gets weaker, and actually, on average, these regions tend to seem to be isotropic. But we did find some interesting anomalies, and one of the first regions that really popped up in S-GlobeRANI was the Tonga-Kermadec region. Before jumping into that, I'm not entering into the details of how we built S-GlobeRANI, but just I highlight here the key points. The key points being that we used a massive data set of over 55 million measurements, combining surface wave group and phase velocity data in a broad range of periods, both for the fundamental mode and overtones. And we combine it also with a large set of body wave travel time data. And the key thing is that by combining this massive data set, we really have sensitivity from the crust with the group velocity data to the lowermost mantle with the body wave travel time data, and with the transition zone being, for example, constrained by the overtones. Importantly as well, we jointly inverted for crustal and mantle structure because we found that if we don't account properly for the crust, we really can map incorrect anisotropy structure into the mantle. When it comes to the forward and inverse modeling, we used quite classical techniques. We are working on also improving that, but that was mostly because these global inversions are really very heavy computationally, so they are computationally quite fast. And so I was saying that when we started looking at S-GlobeRANI, we found some very interesting anomalies in the Tonga-Kermadec region. So in particular, this is a cross-section here. You see Australia here. This is the Tonga region here. And so we really got these very prominent anomalies. We did loads of resolution and robustness tests to really verify that they are not artifacts and that they are as robust as they can be. Here on the left, I've got corresponding isotropic cross-section. And so you can see quite nicely here the Tonga slab, which is stagnant at the 660, the dashed line. You can see the seismicity. And then we have this very strong low-velocity anomaly that other isotropic models also show that seems to be coming all the way from the core mantle boundary to the surface. And it seems really to contact the slab. And so we interpret this as being a large-scale upwelling corresponding to the Samoa plume. And so by comparing the isotropic with the anisotropic images, we see that this blue fast SH anomaly really seems to be behind the slab. You can see the seismicity here. This is roughly where the slab is. Behind the slab and kind of mostly being associated with the upwelling anomaly, whereas the slab seems to be mostly associated with this fast SV anomaly in the transition zone and also going into the uppermost lower mantle. And so our sort of interpretation is, okay, there seems to be this huge anomaly, so indicating huge deformation in the uppermost lower mantle, so going down to about 1,200 kilometers depth, which is the depth represented here. And so we hypothesize that maybe this is basically representing an interaction between the plume and the slab in the deep mantle. And so in order to test whether this was physically plausible, with Manuele Facenda, we ran lots of geodynamical models. So Manuele has a very nice toolkit whereby he does the geodynamical modeling and then from the geodynamical model uses the direct kinematic model to compute the fabrics. And so to compute the VS and anisotropy that we can then directly compare with our model. And so Manuele ran lots of simulations, over 50 simulations, for different parameters in the geodynamical simulations, but also importantly looking at what's the effect of the slab alone, what's the effect of the slab with the plume, and also considering the effects of a plateau attached to the slab, emulating the Ikorangi plateau that occurs in this region. And so this that I show here in the bottom, this is an example of one of the models that fitted well with the tomography. So this is basically the perturbations in VS that Manuele got. And this is the perturbations in radial anisotropy. And this is for a model where he's got the slab, he's got the plume, and as well the plateau, which seemed to be the best fitting model for the tomography. And of course, there are lots of parameters, lots of uncertainties affecting these calculations, particularly like we need to know the slip systems of the main anisotropic minerals. So this is the slip system in particular for bridgmanite. As we saw yesterday in Hauke's talk, there's not lots of data for bridgmanite. We really need more data. So we looked in the literature at the few results from experiments, but also from ab initio calculations, and this is one of the proposed ones. And you can see that at least qualitatively, indeed, we got a good match between the these best-fitting geodynamical modeling plus fabric mantle fabrics calculations compared with the tomography. What we also found from looking at the simulations themselves was that actually the plume seems really to favor, to favor the stagnancy of the slab. And what we also saw is that actually there seems to be a coupled effect between the plume and this fast retreat, the fast retreat of the slab, which is really quite nice because the Tonga slab is one of the fastest retreating slabs on Earth. So we can also explain not just the tomography, but also some geological observations. And more generally, what this suggests is really that mantle plumes can be very, very dynamic, not just these very passive features. So we then looked at other regions. So this is a very special setting, of course, with the slab and the plume. So we looked at subduction regions in general. So here I show a number of cross-sections. So the big ones are for isotropic structure, and the smaller ones are for radial anisotropy structure. So we have cross-sections here in the northern corral. You can see the slab here penetrating. So this is 410, 660, and then just for reference, the 1,000-kilometer depth. So you can see the slab nicely going into the lower mantle. And this is for Honshu, so you see the slab being stagnant here. You have the seismicity here. And then we've got Western Java, more complex setting, with the slab going into well into the lower mantle. And then here, Kermadec, so just south of what I showed in Tonga, where the slab also goes into the lower mantle. And when we looked at the anisotropy, what we found is that there's always these features here, these fast SH anomalies in the uppermost lower mantle. So this is basically between 660 and about 1,000 kilometers depth. So the anomalies are about 2%, and even in other subduction regions that do not necessarily have such good coverage, like South America and so on, we also found these anomalies. So there really seems to be this ubiquitous presence of anisotropy in the top of the lower mantle. Needless to say, we did lots and lots of resolution tests, leakage tests, some statistical tests as well, whether this was meaningful or just noise, and they really seem to be very robust. And then obviously we asked ourselves what's causing these anomalies. So again, with Manuele, we ran many subduction models and calculated the fabrics, this time only considering the effect of the slab alone. Basically, this is now two examples of results from Manuele's calculations. One for a slab in the Japan region that is stagnant. So the green contours that you see here are the contours of the slab coming from the isotropic image superimposed on the anisotropic image. And so this is what we get just from the subduction process alone, associated with the flow just due to the slab stagnating. And this is now calculated for, again, one example of slip system for bridgmanite suggested in the literature. And here on the right, we've got an example in Western Java, basically of a slab that penetrates into the lower mantle, again, the green contour here. And so you can see, again, that at least to first order, we get a good match, a quite nice match between the fabrics calculations in the geodynamics and the observations in the tomography. Also what is quite nice is that we could identify four different possible bridgmanite slip systems that lead to a good agreement between the geodynamical calculations and the tomography. So I'm very eager to see more experiments hopefully coming up to see if these make sense or not from an experimental point of view. And also importantly, what I think is quite nice is that, so basically the anisotropy is calculating only in the presence of dislocation creep that gets activated by high stresses. That's how this framework works. And so it seems that dislocation creep around slabs in the top of the lower mantle seems to be a very reasonable mechanism for these observations, relatively simple mechanism, which I also found quite nice. Yesterday, Sebastian was asking about whether the transition zone or the this upper part of the lower mantle or anisotropic. So what we found is really that on average they are isotropic, but we do find these anomalies in the uppermost lower mantle and also the transition zone around slabs. So that's kind of the take-home message. So this is obviously very exciting. I've been really enjoying doing this work. I think it's really nice to do this multidisciplinary work, but obviously this is just the beginning. There are many limitations. And so in global tomography, we still do not really report uncertainties. We obviously do lots of resolution tests, and we do really as many as we can. But still, Christophe nicely introduced yesterday, we really need to get maps of uncertainties at the global scale and also maybe appraise our models even in more quantitative ways. We also, so far, our comparisons between seismology and geodynamics are nice, but it's just like, oh yeah, it looks like, so it's quite qualitative, which I think actually for now it's fine because there are anyway so many uncertainties. We just want to capture the first order features, but we really need to do more integrated approaches and we need more data, particularly for the oceans. This is a big issue in seismology. And so starting with this first point here, this is just some very recent work that we have done. So starting with S-Globe RANI, you know, since we built it, obviously there are more data available. So we could just have started from scratch and let's do another model. But we said, well, no, let's just try to really assess in a quantitative way what are the features in S-Globe RANI that we can improve? What are the features that we can still, that the data still require to be improved? And so we focused for now, we started this study in the Pacific, focusing on the Pacific and in the upper mantle of the Pacific. So what we've done is we compiled an independent seismic data set of basically waveforms that were not used to build the model, which correspond to these paths shown here, all these paths. Then what we've done is we computed theoretical seismograms for these paths using the spectral element method, which is currently the most advanced method that we have to simulate wave propagation, using as input model S-Globe RANI. And it's more sophisticated than what we used to build S-GlobeRunny, so it's independent. And then we compared the synthetic waveforms with the real data. And we computed phase differences between the synthetic versus data. And this is what is plotted here. Because we wanted to see, are there specific paths that are not fitting as well as others? And so basically the gray paths fit reasonably well, whereas the colored paths do not fit so well. So this is for love waves with 60 seconds. So you can see this bunch here of paths, basically the synthetics are too slow compared to the data. Whereas for Rayleigh waves, this path, the same sort of paths actually, they are too fast. And you can see some light blues ones here that also are a little bit too fast. And so then what we've done is we used these phase misfits as, thank you. We use these phase misfits as our anomalies that we want to use for an inversion, using S-GlobeRunny as the starting model. So basically aiming to improve S-GlobeRunny. So we inverted these phase misfits for isotropic and anisotropic structure. And this is what we got. Again, I'm just showing 100 kilometers depth. We have other depths in the upper mantle. So this is where we started. This is how S-GlobeRunny looked at 100 kilometers depth. These are now the corrections that have been required from our updated inversions. This is the final perturbations in radial anisotropy, and this is the final absolute radial anisotropy, psi being the ratio of VSH over VSV squared. And so what we can see that is really quite nice is that basically, as you could already guess from those paths that required improvement, this stripe that you see here just got broader. You can see it quite nicely here in the absolute anisotropy as well. And so our data seems to require an asymmetry in the radial anisotropy around the East Pacific rise, which nicely matches the asymmetry in the ridge process itself, in the spreading process. And so with stronger anisotropy to the west than to the east, we kind of speculate that it might be due, for example, by some LPO due to associated with asthenospheric flow, maybe beneath the South Pacific superswell, very active region. And you can also see comparing the original with the updated model that we've got stronger anomalies here in the Nazca South America subduction zone, possibly just due to mantle entrainment associated with the subduction. And as well, when we looked at the anisotropy as a function of age, going from the ridge, say, to Japan, it seems to reduce with lithospheric age, again, maybe because of a deviation from this purely horizontal flow into deviated flow because of the slabs being entrained. But I think the key points as well that I want to highlight is that I think this data simulation approach is quite promising, whereby instead of just all the time restarting, building new models, we can actually start from the models that we exist and just keep updating them as new data come in. And it could be other types of data as well, not even just seismic data. Now, moving on into the second point, we are now working as well to do more integrated seismological and geodynamical analysis. And again, when it comes to understand what can and what cannot be resolved by tomography, obviously, we do as many resolution and robustness tests as we can, but obviously we always ask ourselves, are the tests being realistic? Am I using realistic structures? And so geodynamics is very good for that. And so basically we have been doing now some synthetic tomographic inversions where we use our input comes from geodynamics. So we have been doing some 2D ridge to slab models, geodynamical models, which then are used as inputs to do fabrics calculations, again, using this D-Rex approach, considering the 21 elastic constants. And so here I just show cross-sections of perturbations in VS and in radial anisotropy from this particular model that we've been using, but bear in mind that we don't have only radial anisotropy, there's really the full 21 elastic constants. These are constant depth sections from 25 to 200 kilometers depth of the perturbations in VS and in radial anisotropy. And this is the grid that we have been considering to then compute synthetic seismograms. This is a zoom. And so it's quite dense. So we have a station in every single dot, so a very idealized station coverage, especially being in the oceans. And those beach balls are the earthquakes that we use. And so we computed synthetic seismograms for that configuration about 10,000 paths with periods greater than 24 seconds. And then we used the surface waveform partitioned inversion method to invert for isotropic and radially anisotropic structure. This is a very widely used method by many different groups. We are using one by Suzanne van der Leys group, and we jointly invert for crustal and mantle structure. And so I'll just show you some very preliminary initial results. So just please take it with a pinch of salt, because we just got the results pretty much last week. And basically, what you can see here is that this is the input model that I just showed, and this is an example of output model, which I think we will all agree that is not very satisfactory. When it comes to the radial anisotropy, actually it looks better on my screen than here. This definitely looks more red. But when it comes to the anisotropy, we kind of get the right colors broadly, so blue becoming red, it's really looking better here, and then blue again. And very frankly, when we interpret anisotropy, that's about what we interpret. Like we don't interpret the details because we know it's not so well resolved. But to me, the thing that was really surprising is actually the retrieval of the isotropic structure. So you can see the slab in particular gets really extremely smeared. So the slab has about 300 kilometers thickness, and it gets almost 1,000. As I say, it's a shame the coloring is not working so well. This is, again, looking a little bit more red here. But we get, you see, artifacts in the shallow structure as well, these blue anomalies that are not in the input model. This is at about almost in the middle of our grids of stations. If we go even closer to the edges, it gets even worse. And I'm really sorry the colors are not working, but this slab here, I can just describe what I have in my screen. The anomaly, the blue anomaly, comes a little bit like this. It looks a bit like a stagnant slab, which doesn't really correspond at all with the input. And so this is really highlighting we have to be obviously very careful when interpreting our images, and including when interpreting isotropic structures. And then finally, when it comes to these last points, in terms of, we need more data. In terms of the anisotropy, I showed results using surface wave and body wave data, but normal modes are also a promising one. Please check out Federica's poster, who has been working on the observability of normal modes. We still need toroidal modes in particular, that's a challenge, but we need to know what can really constrain the anisotropy. Just finishing, we also need data for the oceans. That's really a big challenge. So like the synthetic inversion tests that I showed based on geodynamics, it was assuming this amazing grids, which we really don't have. Even with the Pacific Ray, we don't have that. But we did definitely need more data from the oceans. There have been very nice efforts like the RAM-RAM deployment and others. But we need to continue that. And so I've been fortunate to get a project to study upward mantle flow generally, which involves collecting new data as well. And so last summer, in July and August, we led a large-scale ocean bottom seismometry expedition in the Azores, Madeira, Canary Island region. This is the research vessel that we use, leaving Lisbon, amazing weather. This is an example of one of the OBSs that we deployed. So we deployed in total 50 OBSs. This is the route that we followed from Lisbon. Each square that you see corresponds to an OBS. Different colors are OBSs from different pools. That's basically, hopefully they are now all recording quietly, hopefully recording the La Palma eruption as well. In total, it was about 4 weeks at sea. We took almost 10,000 kilometers en route. 15 scientists, there are four of us here, Frederick Tillman and his student Peter Mack, and also Ogi Marinier from UCL, as well as myself. 17 very nice ship crew, and we will leave them now recording for a year, and we'll collect them next year. If you're interested, check us out at the websites and also Twitter and Instagram. And so basically to conclude, we have built this globally a radially anisotropic model. We believe that we see very exciting features such as a deep interaction between the Samoa plume and the Tonga slab. We also see these fast anisotropy anomalies, fast SH anomalies in the uppermost lower mantle around subduction zones. They seem to be, at least in first order, compatible with a deformation mechanism dominated by dislocation creep in the lower mantle, which is nice because it's nice and simple. and interesting. We have updated S-Globe Rani into this S-Pacific Rani model in the Pacific that seems to show an asymmetry in anisotropy, east-west asymmetry near the east-Pacific rise, and also a reduction in the anisotropy as a function of lithospheric age. And our very, very initial demographic inversions based on geodynamical models really suggest cautions with interpretation. So we seem to be right just to interpret the colors of the radial anisotropy images, but maybe sometimes when it comes to VS, we also need to be a little bit more careful. But as I said, that's all quite preliminary. And finally, hopefully there's a new data set on the way from the mid-Atlantic, and I hope that we will be able to be doing more in the Atlantic in particular. There's the Pacific Array. In the Atlantic, there's not much happening, and I think we need to push this forward. So thank you, and if you have any questions, yeah.